Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are bringing an action-packed episode here for you this evening, and I'm really excited to do that. And of course, when there's action, there's Sam. Hey, Sam.
Well, I don't know that I've had as much action as Kyle has, but we're going to get to that in a minute. I'm sitting at 50 degrees today in Colorado, and the snow's melting, and we'll have to see how it is up in the mountains. And Kyle has not only weather for us, but a little bit of discussion on the X Games that just concluded. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Sam, and everyone out there in Disaster Podcast land. Coming to you from the post-X Games world here in Aspen, Colorado. It's been a pretty nice stretch of weather that we've had up here in Colorado. Sam, as you were hinting at, it definitely feels more like spring than the end of January. I was skiing around in my base layer and vest today, if you can believe it, up here in the mountains. Looking ahead nationwide at the forecast and things, heavy rain and snow in the Pacific Northwest and below normal temps across the northern half of the U.S. coming through this next week. Warm and dry is still on the order for the west and southwestern U.S., as has been the trend for the majority of the season. That's the quick bit on the weather side of things. But as you mentioned, Sam, yes, we just wrapped up the Winter X Games 2018 edition here in Aspen, Colorado. I was very privileged to be leading the ski patrol component of the athlete medical team this year. It was a fantastic team. We worked with some great folks from all of our public safety agencies here in the Roaring Fork Valley, in addition to other folks from Medicine in Motion, as well as from ESPN directly. So we had two significant injuries to kind of bracket the event, one on the first day and one on the last night. Those of you that were watching things live on Sunday night may have seen one of those snowboarders, his nickname is iPod, take a pretty significant fall in the superpipe. It was definitely the biggest response that we had all week, but it's good to hear. We got word today that he is doing well. So definitely lots to look forward to for next year. We learned a lot. We grew together as a team, and overall it went really, really well. So that's my quick update from here, Sam. Back to you.
Well, good to hear that. And interestingly, we're kind of leaning into a topic on event medicine. We're hoping that either Jim Logan or Dr. Joe will be able to pop in at some point in this podcast. So just to let you know, they might be here too. But right now, it's us.
I do want to add one more thing, because I wanted to get Kyle's take on a news item that we just saw pop up this morning. Link, Kyle, on the 150 skiers rescued by helicopter from a broken chairlift in Austria?
Yes, Jamie, I did see that. It's a topic near and dear to my heart as the lift evacuation coordinator here at Buttermilk Mountain. It's something that we stay in touch with here as to what chairlift events are going on worldwide. And that was definitely one of the more significant ones that I've seen. It's not the first one to come out of Europe this season. We've had a couple so far that we've talked about briefly here on the Disaster Podcast. But again, just showing the good team approach to things, both from the aerial platforms with helicopters, which unfortunately we don't have access to here up where I work, but also the ground-based teams that jumped in there as well. So absolutely, you know, training and pre-planning is essential to a good success. And they were also very fortunate to have fair weather during their evacuation as well, because that's one of the few times that chairlifts actually stop working during a fair weather event.
Wow, I can just imagine what that was like, because just getting one person off the lift is difficult. But it's interesting, we're going to go from snow to fire in sorts. We have Dr. Kailash, otherwise known as KK Panja, who we have a number of topics. This guy has all kinds of things going on. But one of the things you do, KK, and we want you to tell them a little bit about you, but, you know, you do Burning Man. And I don't know how many people know what that's all about. So why don't you introduce yourself and then tell us.
All right. Thank you, Sam. So my name is Kailash, or most commonly known as KK Pandya. I'm a osteopathic physician and currently based out of South Florida. But beginning with the Burning Man community, which is a international art festival community that has been epicentered out of the Black Rock Desert in northern Nevada. My introduction to that community was first in 2004. I started this event at the time. I think this most recent year has been 70,000 people for a week-long event in the Black Rock Desert in northern Nevada, which is a flat, dry lake bed in the middle of nowhere, about 110 miles, I think, from the closest level one trauma center. But every year there's a week-long event in the middle of the desert. I've been able to be a part of this community since 2004, providing emergency services, first as a EMS dispatcher, and then as I got my EMT, grew into that role, and then ultimately went to medical school. And at this point, I was able to go and provide medical care there during my medical school training. And the Burning Man community isn't just the 1 week in the desert where we face some pretty environmentally extreme conditions, but also having anywhere from 30 to 70,000 people in a austere remote environment and providing high quality emergency services care has part of my background prior to going into medical school. And I've been able to weave that throughout my medical career so far. And I love providing medical care at events and festivals, including events through the Burning Man community worldwide.
That's insane. I can't even, I've done a lot of event medicine, but never even close to that many people. And, you know, they get pretty rowdy, as I understand it. There's a lot of alcohol and fun to be had, and things get a little crazy. But you were doing that in 2005, and what happened?
So in 2005, I was volunteering as a member with the Black Rock City Emergency Services Department, which I consider my home department and really where I've learned most of my skills in EMS as well as in medicine. But I was volunteering with the event as a dispatcher during the time. And in the week preceding Labor Day in 2005, was also when Hurricane Katrina was forming up and bearing down on the Gulf Coast. So out of the Burning Man community, as the storm was approaching the coast and came to New Orleans and then veered ultimately into Mississippi, the Burning Man community, we realized that if we can build a city on sand and have a world-class event in such austere environments, that a lot of our skills are likely transferable into acute disaster response. So spontaneously during the Burning Man event in 2005, people started collecting supplies and resources and money was donated, and a disaster relief organization formed out of this event that became Burners Without Borders, which I've been a part of since early 2006 and have participated in several international disaster responses, as well as there's a lot of community development and recovery operations that happen through our organization.
So
go ahead.
No, I just was really impressed with the fact, because I looked up some stuff on your website. You guys donated more than $1 million in demolition and rebuilding services. That's a lot. Plus, I guess while you were there, you did a lot of tech work. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So through the Burning Man community at that time, people came forward with resources and connections, including members of communities that would be in need in Biloxi and New Orleans and throughout the Gulf Coast. And since with the Burning Man event, a lot of our event involves building large-scale art pieces. So we have a lot of heavy equipment operators and riggers and people with mechanical skills that immediately after the event started driving down towards the Gulf Coast and ultimately connected with a Vietnamese Buddhist temple community in Biloxi. And I've seen videos from this temple where during Katrina, they were riding out the storm in the attic of their temple, chest high in water. And so they received our volunteers, our community through Burners Without Borders. And Burners started providing demolition services. A crane operator drove his rig in from coastal Oregon down to Biloxi. And within the first week after the storm, was literally pulling cars out of the road and making a road so they could get to this temple. And we set up a point of distribution with equipment and people who were fresh out of the Black Rock Desert and off the playa. And over the course of several months, we had community members donate everything from cash to throwing fundraisers for our team, to connections through heavy equipment companies, where a heavy equipment manufacturer gave us access to $300,000 worth of heavy equipment in the form of a front end loader and an excavator, really on a handshake deal through trust through the Burning Man community. So we were able to, with that and with a global community supporting our operating costs, we were able to provide at no cost to the community housing demolition services, both in Biloxi and then in the smaller town of Pearlington, Mississippi.
Well, you also set up internet access for them, didn't you? And solar powered. I mean, that's pretty cool.
That was pretty cool. We this was in 2005 when Wi-Fi hotspots were still a very difficult to access piece of technology. A manufacturer gave us access to some beta test equipment that would get us out on a cellular network. And the problem, again, with beta test hardware is it's not always going to work perfectly. So my prior career, prior to medicine, I've been a sysadmin and network security work. So I was able to get this hotspot connected out over the cellular network and connected with another Wi-Fi hotspot, which I had on me. And then another donor had given us a solar array and put the whole thing in Tupperware, and we had solar-powered Wi-Fi, and we were the only internet point of presence for about a 15-mile radius.
Oh, you're a talented guy. So, Kyle, you have any questions or thoughts for KK?
Well, KK, I mean, just kind of looking at how things have evolved from, 2005 until now, where, a lot of these disaster relief organizations have perhaps started up as kind of a one-stop shop. And like you were saying, like for building and demo trades, technology, Wi-Fi, internet access and things, how has Burners Without Borders evolved? Is there any area or areas that you specialize in?
So a lot of my personal involvement over the last 10 years has been more in the acute disaster response phase. But a lot of Burners Without Borders projects, there have been several responses to large-scale disasters like the Peru earthquake, the Haiti quake, Hurricane Sandy, helping out with Ebola response, and then our most recent triple play of hurricanes in September. So there's still a lot of work being done in acute disaster response, but a lot of the Burning Man community is embracing the concept and the flag of Burners Without Borders, not just as disaster relief, but as resiliency work that we're able to help out in the recovery phase, and recognizing that it's not, disasters aren't just natural disasters. They can be slow burn financial disasters, socioeconomic disasters, social disasters, and people are working worldwide as part of our network of volunteers, doing everything from packing backpacks for homeless individuals in the Midwest to helping out in acute disaster response. So we also have teams in the last year that have been developing shipping containers as mobile resource units to be able to deploy during the recovery phase of a disaster, where teams being able to provide the tools and the resources that other disaster responders and community members may need in order to get on with it. So it's become a lot of different things to a lot of people.
That's impressive. Jamie, any thoughts from you?
Well, I like to hear how this sprung out of a seeing a need and filling it. And an organization that had a unique set of talents and skills, putting on something as immense and complicated as Burning Man on an annual basis. And, you know, my understanding is you go into the desert, you take everything in with you, you take everything back out and leave a pristine place behind you. And so, you know, that type of austere environment living is something that is unique, even, I think, to disaster organizations. Would you agree?
It's uncommon, but I've found, as I've in my medical life been more involved in disaster response, it's something that I recognize. It's a kinship amongst disaster responders of being able to do something extraordinary and to leave an area hopefully better than when and where we found it. As you mentioned, Burning Man in Nevada, I believe, is considered the world's largest Leave No Trace event. And it's held on federal land. And by the end, when we have our site sign-off from the BLM, typically the area where the event has been held on the playa, on the Black Rock Desert, is cleaner than its surrounding areas. So, yeah, the ethos from the Burning Man community of trying to leave it better than we found it, I think, is very applicable in disaster response.
Well, on that note, something else I saw on your site. In 2012, you were awarded the Leonard Toe Humanism in Medicine Award for demonstrating outstanding compassion in the delivery of care, respect for patients, their families, and healthcare colleagues, and clinical excellence. That's pretty cool. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So, yes. So that was, thank you for acknowledging that. That was through the Arnold P. Gold Foundation, which was set up to honor humanism in medicine. And Mr. Gold recently passed away last week. I was just informed by email. But this organization lives on in his legacy to respect those who honor and respect humanistic values towards their patients and their colleagues. So I was honored to receive this when graduating med school. And I think the honorarium that came with it, I ultimately ended up using to get to New Jersey after Hurricane Sandy. So putting it back into play.
Wow. So Katrina gave you the bug for disaster medicine, and you went out and you did got into a wilderness emergency medicine program, and I think that's probably where you you met Dr. Ben Abo, who we'll be talking to soon.
Dr. Ben and I, we met in the last year or two here in South Florida through mutual friends and through work. But in 06, I did the Wilderness EMT program through National Outdoor Leadership School, which for me, for context, I was raised in a medical family. Both my parents are also physicians, but we've all come to it through very different means. And for me, doing a wilderness EMT course, I loved it in not just learning how to do things in the front country, but really scenario-based training on how would I apply this with what I would have with me in the field. So I learned how to do a traction splint on a femur, not just with a Sager splint, but how would I build one with my camera tripod and a coffee cup and a thermarest?
We know that one, don't we, Kyle? We learned that on ski patrol. Yes. So
yes. Well.
Let's fast forward to Irma this last year. And you were involved with Broward County on some disaster relief. You want to talk about that?
Yes. Yes. So I live in South Florida in the Fort Lauderdale area and work in Miami. And during Irma, I was activated through the state of Florida and through the Broward Medical Reserve Corps to be a physician provider at a medical special needs shelter. And I'd like to take a moment to give shout outs and respect to the Broward County Department of Public Health, the Broward Emergency Operations Center, and City of Davie Fire Rescue, who I had the honor of working alongside members from each of these teams in a medical special needs shelter during Irma. We had approximately 240 patients in a middle school auditorium that were all considered medical special needs individuals. So about half of the room was oxygen dependent and over half were mobility dependent in one way or another. I think I had three patients with tracheostomies and one patient on a ventilator, all in a middle school auditorium. And so I rode out the storm with the Broward County Public Health Department providing care for this part of our community that otherwise could have really been hurt. I was present for 2 days and nights. There was another physician on site, as well as county nurses, nursing assistants, and public health employees through Broward. And I used every bit of training that I've got through my residency education so far, as well as every bit of wilderness medicine and everything I learned on the desert. And really having to, as we say, run a strong ground game. I didn't have the luxury of being able to evacuate patients during a storm. So we managed as best we could with who and what we had. And some patients were there for as long as 5 days. I was present for 2 days. But in 5 days, with 240 patients that were frankly sicker than I usually see in my hospital, with no loss of life and no significant injuries, I think it was a moment of a big thing done right. And I'm proud to be a part of that team.
Wow, I bet you learned a lot from that event. That's a lot of people. So, Jamie, I bet you have some thoughts on that one.
Well, I was really intrigued and liked hearing how you brought all of these disparate things in your past together. Your medical training as a resident, medical school, EMT, your experience in the desert with Burning Man, your recent wilderness EMT course, and how all of that came together. And we talk a lot about disaster response and the need to be able to improvise and make do with what you have. And I'm curious, you know, what were you the only person that was in that position to have those unique skill sets, or were there other people there that you found from like the health department and others that had their own set of unique skills that you guys ended up putting to work in some unique way?
It's Jamie. There was thankfully a wealth of talented individuals able to provide care on site there, regardless of our circumstance. I working in hospitals here in South Florida, a lot of our community is Hispanic and particularly Cuban expatriates. And I was grateful that the other physician on site she had completed her medical training in Cuba. And when the power was out, well, the power never definitively went out, but not having to stare at a computer screen to figure out what's going on with a patient, but actually being able to assess a patient at bedside alongside a colleague. It's something I worry that in a lot of formal medical education is maybe going by the wayside. So I was grateful that between that and several of the nurses had been, one had been a pediatric ICU nurse before her role with the county. And there were several firefighter paramedics with Davie Fire Rescue who were on station for up to 5 days there at the shelter. And being able to work without ego and across disciplines for what are the needs of the patient and what are our logistical constraints right now. It's an important professional dexterity that I think we all were able to exhibit and share.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that because that's just... you know, as a nurse and a paramedic myself, crossing disciplines, it's important, I think, to talk a lot about the need for us to work without the egos and to work across our teams, disciplines, and really form that care team where we utilize everybody's abilities to the utmost in these types of situations. And that's what I was trying to get at, and you framed it perfectly, because I just think that that's something that we need to focus on and stress in disaster response. And I know, Sam, in your experience, that's been kind of something you've seen as well with your experience with the DMAT and also recently with your response to Harvey and Irma.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that impressed me the most was actually Hurricane Sandy, where if there was an ER that was functional, but they needed extra personnel. So DMAT was set up outside, but as well, they were working in the ER. And to see the federal uniforms next to the, you know, ER folks, and they just got along famously. Good friendships were created out of that. And it was just a really neat thing to see. And one of the terms you used, professional dexterity. I love that. That is a great way to put it. Kyle, any thoughts from you?
Well, to echo Sam, yours and Jamie's comments here, I mean, we have a very similar setup for the Winter X Games, where, you know, we have medical providers from various disciplines and backgrounds all coming together to ultimately affect a positive outcome for anyone who's injured in the field of play. But my question for KK is, you know, kind of looking back at, you know, your response to Irma and your and your team's efforts there in the middle school, what takeaways or lessons would you offer for other medical reserve corps or their members if you could kind of reflect on your experiences there?
So looking back at that and looking back to, I guess, where it really cut my teeth with Black Rock City at Burning Man with the Black Rock Emergency Services Department, recognizing that for me, even though my parents were physicians and I was exposed to physician or to life as a physician early, I really learned so many of what have become my bedside manner and my mindset and my skill set working in the desert alongside firefighters, paramedics, nurses, and PAs, and a whole being able to learn and be mentored by people outside of my professional swim lane, I think has really benefited me in being able to respond in a situation like Irma. And my encouragement to, especially to young physicians who may be going through medical school and residency, is to get involved with your county medical reserve corps, get involved with your county's emergency operations center, and to learn from people outside of the swim lane of being a physician. There's plenty of skills that I recognize I bring to the bedside in my hospital that I only learned in the middle of the night, in the middle of the desert. And I try to share those with my team, but that's one thing I'd love to encourage people to do. Other lessons I learned from those several nights. I was grateful that we didn't lose cell service in the area for data. But I did not have my ham radio equipment with me, and communications is king in a crisis like that. So understanding more of the, especially for healthcare providers who might not work outside of an established clinical setting very often, understanding the logistics of what makes bedside care possible and what makes taking care of the patients and the team possible. And also a big part of my life, definitely since Katrina, and a passion of mine in my medical career as I'm coming into it, is looking out for the mental health and the wellness of other responders. I know that especially as it becomes easier for a disaster responder to be geographically anywhere in a relatively short time and do something very intense and not necessarily have a debrief and have exit screening and aftercare that one might if deploying with a more structured team. And understanding that post-traumatic stress is as responders, we are susceptible to that. And knowing how to recognize that in ourselves and in our teammates and not being afraid of it. We do something extraordinary for the world, and getting banged up in the process, there isn't any shame in that.
Well said, and that is one of our favorite topics, so I'm glad you brought that up. But talking about professional dexterity, my last thing here is, if I can even get this right when I say it, transforming medical imaging, including CT and MRIs, into 3D objects and what you do with that. That's intriguing me, but I'm clueless.
Okay. So, Sam, so prior to and I guess through my medical career, my undergrad experience, I was doing computer science and polymer chemistry research during my undergrad. And I've always been fascinated by medical imaging. I was able to, in high school, be part of a lab affiliated with the Visible Human Project. And so a lot of my professional interests have gone into 3D imaging of the human body. And when I first got introduced to 3D printing in 2011, the first thing I could think to print was, well, a CT scan of a skull is a structured data set of something that I know is possible to build. So I want to start with that. And there's, over the last several years, I've been, one of my passions in medicine is I want to bring I really hate being in clinic and pointing at a computer screen and trying to explain something abstract to a patient. It dehumanizes the whole experience, and I'd much rather be able to give a patient a physical, tangible model of their injury, of their illness. And we can turn off the computers and actually just sit shoulder to shoulder and talk about this thing that they can actually relate is going on in their bodies. And to that effect, part of my research is in building models from CT scans and MRI scans that patients may have in the course of their injury, and being able to give that, both use that for better diagnosis as well as a better patient experience, and also for better medical education. A project I was working on earlier tonight, there's a group with the Airway app that is focusing on airway education for clinical providers, particularly in cricothyroidotomy for an emergency surgical airway. And they've developed a 3D printable model of the trachea and the thyroid cartilage and the hyoid cartilage to give someone a free and open access 3D printable model that can be used for medical simulation training for emergency airway access. A classmate of mine from medical school who went on to do emergency medicine with the U.S. Army, she had recently returned from a tour in Afghanistan, and she said that she requested that she'd love to have 3D printed models for her team at the field hospital that would treat not just U.S. service members, but all comers there. And for being able to provide an emergency surgical airway, which is a high risk, or it's a high stakes, high pucker factor procedure. I've had to do one so far, and yeah, it's exciting. I'll understate it. And she requested some models to be printed for her team at the field hospital there. So I was able to collaborate with my medical school, Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and our librarians there to 3D print about a dozen of these models that we plan to mail tomorrow to a NATO field hospital with the goal of training medical providers in Afghanistan on how to provide emergency surgical airways. So this is training that even as a resident, I'm not formally receiving, but I'm able to, by understanding the technology and understanding what a learner may need, and even just being able to practice and rehearse something that a medic may only do once or twice in their life, being able to practice that prior to having doing it is, it literally can save a life through creative use of 3D printing.
That is fascinating. What do you think of that, Kyle?
I love it. I know 3D printing is kind of one of the new frontiers that's still being explored, especially with regard to emergency medicine and training and things, as KK has suggested. I mean, even in the disaster response realm as well, outside of just emergency medicine, there are things being 3D printed now in the field that are being able to be put to use, whether it's custom tools or widgets and other things. And it really excites me. It was a big topic at several conferences I was at last year, and I'm really, really excited to kind of follow this and see where it goes, especially like from the medical standpoint, and where if you could 3D print a airway model or airway mannequin to train folks with, I mean, just how cool would that be instead of having to always go to a vendor and purchase one? It's really, really cool.
Absolutely. And between that and if high-quality instruction is available to everyone off our phones and off the internet, wherever we happen to be, combining the two and making medical education about pretty critical topics, making that available to all providers, regardless of geography or even with a 3D printer, I think the cheapest I've seen so far is around $120, and you can build it for less. Regardless of economics, I think it's an exciting time to be able to practice and learn medicine in the field as well as in the hospital.
So, Jamie, it's interesting we end up on a training topic yet again. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, and then see what goes from there.
Yeah, well, I really like to hear about this. I've been following some of the maker movements inside of healthcare, where nurses, physicians, techs, anybody in a healthcare community comes up with a novel solution and then comes up with a way to manufacture it on site using 3D printing techniques. And this is something, as Kyle said, can really make a huge change in what we do in disaster response. Because if you can bring a 3D printer with you and a laptop, if you need a laryngoscope blade, you print a laryngoscope blade. You don't have to worry about whether you forgot to bring it in your kit or you've used all the ones, the disposables you had with you. It's something you can create. And that's just one example. I'm curious if what your thoughts are about the future of this opportunity to just create things on demand. I'm curious what you think about that, KK.
It's, with 3D printers being on all seven continents and the space station right now, and I think I want to say 2 or 3 years ago, the first successful 3D print was done on the International Space Station of a socket wrench that was functional with moving parts. And I was able to, on my own printer, within 24 hours of that being printed on the space station and the model being published, I was able to build it and play with it myself. And so being able to close the loop on necessity and supply and really not having to worry about what is the supply chain on the back end, how do we get something to the field if you have the ability to manufacture it in the acute disaster response environment. I think there's a lot of benefit for that, as well as in helping, let's say, bring a hospital or some other critical infrastructure back online. If, let's say, a hinge for a refrigerator was broken and that refrigerator was needed, being able to build the hinge at the point of necessity, I think it can really change the caliber as well as the kind of response we're able to provide in the coming years.
Jamie, I can imagine what Dr. Joe thinks of this. I'm sure he's going to be fascinated with the topic and want to learn more about it. It's almost hard to conceive that we're at the point in time where we can do things like that and what's going to happen the next few years.
Yeah, we're all a little bit nerdy in our own respect and what we think about.
True.
But, you know, I think about, you know, the science fiction of what we can do in television and things, to imagine what we can do. And you think about things like replicators on Star Trek. And yet, what is a 3D printer but a type of replicator? The ability to create something on demand when we need it, where we need it, revolutionizes, I think, the care of medicine around the world. As KK said, you know, on all the continents, we have 3D printers. We can print something that we need immediately and put it to use. And we see this in austere environments, in refugee camps, in places where the world is torn apart by war, and people are using 3D printers to create simple and basic prosthetic devices so that people who've lost limbs due to conflict are able to carry on some measure of normalcy in their lives. And I think that this is just something that we're going to see explode as the technology becomes more and more prevalent and more and more, you know, your basic homes. Consider a 3D printer as ubiquitous as the laser printer or the inkjet printer.
Oh, God, it's hard to imagine. I imagine, though, is it hard to learn that? Or is it, once you know what it's all about, it's basically simple?
So the care and maintenance and, for lack of a better term, feeding and watering of a printer, it can depend on the printer and on one's technical skill set, on what machine they're working with. But there are commercially available, highly reliable 3D printers that can be had for a reasonable sum. And as far as the design, anything that can be done in a CAD environment, computer-aided design environment, could be brought into the world of 3D printing relatively easily. And even if you were pulling something from, video game design is just a variant of CAD design. So I could... one could, let's say, design something in Minecraft and build it in a printer. And
wow.
So I feel like I'm off the power curve on what is currently being done with 3D printing. But in medicine, I know being able to practice. I know we talked about front of neck access for surgical airway, but there are some cases, like let's say in pediatric cardiology, where a person may go through their entire medical training and never have actually encountered a patient with that pathology, or something being so unique and a procedure being so high stakes that the ability of being able to practice on the patient's anatomy and understand it, hold it, play with it, and do that prior to engaging the patient there's a lot that can be done.
Well, and just the creation of the muscle memory by doing that, you know, it's the same reason that we practice and train the way we do in anything, Sam. You know, I think about the training and the experiential type of training that Paragon Medical Education Group does, you know, our sponsors on the show, Dr. Joe and Jim and the rest of them. do hands-on experiential training, because that type of training sticks with you longer. When you live and experience actively an event, even if it's a practice event, when the real thing comes along, you're more accustomed to it by nature already. And so you can respond to it in a more effective manner. And what KK just explained about, someone having a unique problem with their anatomy, being able to use a 3D imaging of that anatomy, print out the actual piece of anatomy, the heart or the lungs or the brain or whatever the case may be, and visualize in right in front of you the tumor or the defect or whatever the case may be, and be able to navigate on the model again and again and again until you get the technique exactly the way you want it, then translate that to the surgical suite, is just invaluable. And I think that just links back to our focus here at the end of every episode on the importance of training and what they do at Paragon. And so I think it's a great segue to that. I'd just like to thank them for continued support of the show and remind everybody that even though Dr. Joe's not here, we can still go over and let them know thanks for supporting the Disaster Podcast. Go over to ParagonMedicalGroup.com. Leave a message over there. Contact them. And definitely reach out to them. They are able to find funding sources to bring educational things to your system. So if you're trying to train for active shooters, or you're trying to train for a tornado response or a collapsed building or whatever the case may be, they can come into your community and create that special training just for you. And they can work a way to do it with you on a budget. So get out and reach out to them over at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. Find them on Facebook on the same name, or reach out to them on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU. And again, we'd like to thank them for their continued support. KK, is there a place people can find you? I know we're going to have links to Burners Without Borders, which is what you have, burnerswithoutborders.org. So I have that already linked here. But is there anywhere else people could probably reach out to you if they had questions about 3D printing, for instance?
Let's see. On Facebook, I'm available as KK Pandya, P-A-N-D-Y-A, so KK P-A-N-D-Y-A. And on Twitter, my handle is Namastizzle. N-A-M-A-S-T-I-Z-Z-L-E. And those are probably the two most reliable ways to reach me at this time. And I'm still setting up my website, but I'm back in the hospital for actually a month of inpatient medicine tomorrow. So that might still be forthcoming. Maybe I'll have it up by the time this airs.
Believe me, we're all constantly working on getting our websites in order.
It seems amen. Like
a never-ending process. But
all right.
Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I know Joe's going to be sorry he wasn't able to chime in and ask some questions, but I think we covered quite a bit on this episode, and we thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, and some of our community from Burners Without Borders, I'd love to get your team in touch with more of our team so we can talk about more of the different projects that are actively happening around the world through the Burning Man community. And I know at the Airway Project, I've been collaborating with Dr. Ben Abo on this, and maybe you can have us on for a twofer to talk about that as it further develops.
That would be fast. That would be fantastic. I think that would be great. So thank you again for coming on. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to connect with me online, add me on LinkedIn. I'd love to continue the conversation going forward.
Sam, how about you?
Well, find me at all the social medias under SamBradley11 or Sam Bradley. And we definitely have to get KK into the Facebook group. And you can also find us on the disasterpodcast.com website.
Excellent.
How about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most places out there in social media. So a friend, follow me or otherwise keep up with what I'm doing out there. And we want to thank you all for checking out this particular episode. I'm going to see if we can turn it into a double episode. We'll see. So this might be the second half of a two-parter. But in any case, I just want to thank Dr. KK Pandya for coming on, and also Kyle and Sam. And Sam, talking about the beginnings of the Burning Man, Burners Without Borders organization, all the way up to and including KK's experiences with Hurricane Irma this year. We've covered quite a bit, but there seems to be a common theme.
There is a common theme, and it's can translate into everything we talked about tonight, that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.